Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It's a great privilege to have with us a man who has responsibility for overseeing our intelligence agencies as a member of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. He also serves on the Appropriations Committee and the Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committees in the United States Senate. He's Senator James Lankford from Oklahoma. It's a great privilege to have him with us, and thank you, Senator, for your time.
I'm very glad to be here with you.
You spoke shortly before the Senate went into recess on the floor about your concerns about the Obama bomb deal, the negotiated arrangement with Iran. Give us, if you would, very quickly, your sense of what's wrong with that picture and how the Senate ought to proceed with respect to it.
The challenge is the president continues to come back and focus and say, we're not going to trust Iran, we're going to verify. Of the many loopholes that are in this deal, the biggest one is they can't verify. They continue to say the words verify, but they can't actually do it. The IAEA, which is the UN organization that will actually do the inspections, which, by the way, according to the agreement, no Americans can be a part of that inspection team ever. So this UN body that's going to come in and do the inspections, they have a separate agreement with Iran to how they're going to actually verify. So literally, I can't read that agreement. John Kerry has told me he hasn't seen it. He won't read it. No member of the administration will see it or read it. So we literally cannot verify how they're going to verify these locations. They just say we're going to, but there's no process to actually know how they're going to actually do that. They're only looking for uranium. They're not dealing with their ballistic missiles program. They're not dealing with triggering devices. They're not dealing with delivery vehicles. They're only trying to search for uranium and just locked in on that one element. And it ignores the reality that uranium could be purchased from Pakistan. Uranium could be purchased from North Korea. There are other places to do it. We're not actually trying to get back to any of their previous military dimensions, find out what they have done in the past. Just over and over again, as you go through the talk of inspections, you continue to find one more loophole after another. And some of the largest of them include that if we ever, what they call snapback sanctions, if we ever try to reimpose sanctions, Iran can see that as a violation of our side of the deal, regardless of what they've done, and they can walk away entirely. The two things Iran needs to be able to get to a bomb is time and money. And this deal provides them more time to continue their research and about $6 billion of international money that's been parked around the world in the sanctions. So they get time and money on this, and we get nothing in return.
It sounds from what you've said, Senator James Lankford, that when the president makes representations not only about the verification being the most comprehensive in the history of the world, but the pathways to a bomb being completely foreclosed and Iran really have forsworn pursuing nuclear weapons, that these are, to put a fine point on it, fraud, misrepresentations.
Yeah, there's no way they continue to talk about they're going to shut down every pathway towards getting to any materials or any construction. All the supply chain, they continue to say, it's not possible to be able to track down all supply chain areas to be able to get into Iran. So they're trusting on the intelligence community, which are some fantastic people, and they do great work to protect the United States. But they would tell you even they can't go and find every single pathway of every single part of the supply chain to be able to protect it. So the administration says they're going to have inspections, but they don't know how those inspections are going to have. They'll continue to say they're going to be thorough, but they don't know how the inspections are actually going to be done. And they're hoping that they can pick up every part of the supply chain so they can catch it before they actually advance. But all those are hope. That's not a real plan, and that's not a real possibility to be able to get that with great certainty.
Senator, let me ask you about the International Atomic Energy Agency you mentioned a moment ago. They will be submitting a report that is likely to come out with a finding that there is no active nuclear weapons program in Iran at the moment, which, as I understand the terms of this agreement, could trigger the removal in very short order of both the embargo on conventional weapons shipments to Iran and ballistic missile technology. Is that your understanding? And if so, doesn't this problem become vastly worse right away?
Could be. There are several different deadlines here. The initial one is that the IAEA will have to certify that during the first stage of compliance, and then after that, they'll begin their inspections. Once they go and start their inspections process, then they set the timeline of what they consider that this is for peaceful purposes for their nuclear program. Now, there's no certain timeline that's set on that. It's just whenever they are feel satisfied that it's for peaceful purposes based on their inspections. The interesting thing is the way the agreement is written, there is clearly an OR in this agreement. So they'll talk about their 8 years of sanctions or whenever the IAEA determines their nuclear programs for peaceful purposes. Is that 2 years? Is that 6 months? Is that 8 years? No one knows, and there's no definite definition of that. It is any time period that the UN determines, yes, we believe they're in compliance and this is a peaceful program, then all those sanctions are lifted much faster. So again, the president continues to talk about 8 years, 10 years, 15 years for different parts of it. All of those have an or attached to it, and it's for when the UN actually determines that this is a peaceful purpose nuclear program, then all bets are off.
Senator James Lankford, as I mentioned, you're a member of the Senate Homeland Security Committee as well as the Intelligence Committee. Recently, you approved out of committee a measure called the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act, which argues that we need a strategy for protecting our electric grid. One of my real concerns has been that the Iranians understand the vulnerability of the electric grid and seem to be pursuing techniques, perhaps cyber, perhaps electromagnetic pulse, to exploit that vulnerability. This could give rise, really, in the fullness of time at least, to an existential threat. How serious a problem do you regard that to be, and how urgent should we be addressing it?
The EMP, electromagnetic pulse technology, has been around for a very long time. It's the ability to be able to detonate a device over the earth to be able to put out a magnetic pulse, and for a region, it would knock out all power for that area. Now, if you can just imagine what happens in many of our major cities, if power is knocked out not just for hours, but for weeks, for months, and what happens with life safety, what happens with emergency response, what happens with food distribution. Our cities and towns are not set up for that. So the key issue that we have is not only a device, but just a solar storm could send out the kind of pulse that could actually take down electricity. So this is a vulnerability that we have. This is an area that has been discussed for a long time, and it's one of those things that we can proactively address, and then if once we address it, we don't have to be as concerned about it because we have the possibilities there. So it's basic breakers, the systems that have to be in place along the lines. That is repetition of a lot of the transformer lines, because those will all be blown, so we have to have enough in backup that we can actually respond and get those back up in time. All those things can be done. This technology that is possible, we're just pushing it to say, let's move it from we can protect ourselves to we did protect ourselves on it. This is not an area that is a pie-in-the-sky fantasy. This is real technology that exists and that Iran could have, and so we want to make sure that we are very, very well protected on that.
Senator, and we've only got about a minute left, but very quickly, just your thoughts on what we're hearing about the Hillary Clinton email problems and the degree to which this may represent a real blow to U.S. intelligence and security.
The big challenge is obviously there's a political issue and a presidential campaign going on, but get all those dynamics. But let's get back to just the real raw facts of what's happening. If there are top secret files that are on a non-secured server that Iran, that North Korea, that China, that Russia could actually get access to and have vulnerabilities to, that is an enormous security risk for the United States, and it's a very sloppy process for someone who is Secretary of State. We now know there were top-secret files that were on that server, and we're trying to find out how many are out there and obviously what happened to them, and if we can track how many places those things went. And to believe as Secretary of State that international actors are not trying to get to your files, or to say, if I store them in my house, which was the initial line, we had Secret Service around the house, and so nobody could get to it, I think is a little naive. This is not an issue of someone breaking in and stealing physically the server that has now been handed over to the FBI. These are hackers that get into the line, and you do not see them, and a Secret Service agent outside the building is not going to slow that down. So we have major issues that we have to deal with. I handle top secret documents all the time through my position in the intelligence community. I can tell you I would never, ever put them on a private server. I would never take them out of the secure facilities that they are stored in to make sure those documents are handled correctly. I would hope the same for a Secretary of State or someone who wishes to be president.
Well, we are on notice that it's a felony offense to do otherwise, so it certainly seems as though it should be a disqualifier with respect to judgment, if not disabling fact, if there's a prosecution. Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma, thank you very much for joining us here at Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to talk with you, sir. We appreciate your service. Enjoy your time off, and we'll look forward to your leadership on the Iran deal when you get back. Next up, a fascinating insight into the private military contractors and the role they're playing in our national security. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Gaffney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined for the first time, I believe, by Sean McFate, a man who has distinguished himself in uniform as a paratrooper with the glorious 82nd Airborne Division. He also served as a contractor with outfits like DynCorp International, and In the course of both of those capacities, of course, was about the nation's business, doing hard things, often in the dark of night. He has written about these experiences and his insights, arising also from his experience as a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and as an associate professor at National Defense University and my alma mater, the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, in a new book entitled The Modern Mercenary, Private Armies, and What They Mean for World Order. Sean McFate, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Thank you for all of this service to our country. It's deeply appreciated, and I know it has, as I say, informed the thesis of your new book. Give us a flavor of what you mean by modern mercenaries and the important role they are playing at the moment in the nation's security.
Sure. Well, this started because I myself was in the private military industry, which our country has used extensively in Iraq and Afghanistan, and others are using it around the world as well. And I think the industry has gotten, in some ways, a very bad rap, and I wanted to sort of give an insider's insight into what the industry does well, but also flag from insider's point of view some of the deep concerns about the industry, too.
And in terms of the good, let's start with that. At a time particularly when the resources of the United States military are being severely constrained, shall we say, obviously this private military industry, as you say, has become increasingly important. How important?
Well, sure. So the industry, by and large, is cheaper to use than the military, just like renting a car is cheaper than owning one, right? And this is historical, too. We have a lot of historical examples of this. They can do some things better than the U.S. government can. They are not beholden to red tape in the same way the U.S. government is, or they're not fighting, you know, bureaucratic turf wars. When I was a contractor in Africa, we built an army for Liberia, a small West African country that is still standing today and doing reasonably well. And I could do things as a contractor that I really couldn't do if I was still an officer in the U.S. Army because of bureaucratic red tape. So there are some advantages to using this industry in terms of cost-cutting, effectiveness, private sector innovation, etc. So we all remember Blackwater in 2007, which killed 17 Iraqi civilians at Nisour Square in Baghdad. You know, from the locals' point of view, they can't tell the difference between Blackwater guards and, say, U.S. military Marines. They all look the same. They're all Americans. They're all carrying weapons. So, and that became a huge catastrophe for the U.S. in the region, where we had the Secretary of State having to apologize to the entire region, which as a superpower is, you know, not good. Congressional inquiries, questions of who actually controls these military contractors, the lack of transparency. I mean, in some ways, these companies are a lot more opaque than the CIA or the Pentagon, because if you're a journalist, you can do a Freedom of Information request for the CIA or the Pentagon, there's congressional oversight committees, but for the private sector, there's none of that, and they could hide behind the fact that everything they do, they claim is proprietary knowledge, is trade secrets, so you don't really know what they do. And this is one of the reasons, I think, why the executive branch and others can be attracted, in fact, to the industry, because it affords them a sense of plausible deniability in case something goes really bad, and it creates moral hazard in public policy making.
And that moral hazard bit is a piece that I'm particularly interested in. To the extent that one of the advantages of these military contractors is, as you said earlier, that there's less bureaucratic red tape, there's, well, less oversight. Do you find that the abuses are arising from government direction to some extent, or turning a blind eye to some of the conduct, or is it simply something that is done when things just go frightfully badly within one of these companies?
Well, I think there's three reasons why you have problems like this. The first is that these companies are operating in really complex environments. You know, to be fair to anybody working in conflict-torn Iraq or Afghanistan, you know, things don't go according to plan, but that's not an excuse, right? The other two reasons, I think, is that the government itself
has failed to manage a lot of these companies. And, you know, it's easy for journalists to blame the industry for fraud, waste, and abuse, but we also have to look at the other side of the equation. Who's managing? There's still not a regulatory framework for using these companies overseas. How the Pentagon does it is very different than how the State Department does it. It's almost like a left-hand, right-hand problem. But lastly, these companies, you know, these are private sector companies, and they also have some role in this because there's a conflict of interest between, you know, public sector ends with private sector means. Companies are motivated to basically elongate conflicts for profit, or, you know, historically in the past, not in United States America, to even start conflicts. And we see this a lot in the Middle Ages, where war was fought mostly by mercenaries. And what happens in a world where you fight mostly with mercenaries is that there's, not surprisingly, a lot more war. And this is the concern I have with the book, is what direction are we going to post-Iraq, post-Afghanistan?
Yeah. Let me just ask as another case study, Syria. It is a place where I assume contractors are involved in some of this training that we're doing of so-called Syrian moderates or Syrian rebels. You've correctly, obviously, Sean McVeigh, captured the complexities of operating in some of these environments. In Syria, I think it's particularly difficult because who knows whether any of these people, in fact, are moderate or likely to remain aligned with us once trained. The record so far is not very good. Just as a prescription, really, going forward, based on your insider experiences chronicled so well in The Modern Mercenary, Private Armies and What They Mean for World Order, what would you recommend be done to try to make this, particularly in this case, perhaps, but more generally, work as properly and adequately as we can do?
Well, I mean, first, there's sort of two parts to that. The first is, what is the wisdom of this policy of, you know, training local fighters to fight on our behalf? We, as you say, we don't have a good track record, and security force assistance is not something that the military spends a lot of time wanting to do. I think our military, in my opinion, its core identity is a military of assault and not occupation. And security force assistance is basically occupation. Second of all, you don't know, like, who you're training and equipping. You know, today they could fight for you, tomorrow they could fight for somebody else. We've seen this in Afghanistan, right? So there's the question of that. The second question is, who are the contractors? How are they vetted? How are they trained? How do we know they're competent? And this is a problem you see in the private sector around, you know, anywhere. You know, what's the due diligence process? I think the government's really bad at due diligence. They basically they keep on rehiring incumbents whether or not they perform well, because it's bureaucratic inertia is what it is. But the other thing about Syria, which is really interesting, is that there's also contractors and mercenaries on the other side. There's rumors of Russian mercenaries operating in Syria on behalf of the Alawite regime. And we're in a world now where, after the U.S. has used private military contractors, we're seeing outright mercenaries, which are different, starting to appear around the world. Nigeria just hired a group of mercenaries to go after Boko Haram, a radical extremist Islamic group in North Nigeria. 6 years, the Nigerian military could not deal with Boko Haram, and in a few weeks, these mercenaries forced them out of the country.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. Sean, a lot more to talk about on all of this, and I hope you'll indulge us by coming back soon, because I think, as you say, there are vexing questions here. And the distinction between mercenaries on the one hand and these private military industrial types is one that I'd love to explore with you further. In the meantime, thank you very much for joining us today and for this terrific book, The Modern Mercenary, Private Armies and What They Mean for World Order. Next up, we'll speak with former governor and White House Chief of Staff John Sununu about New World Orders, past and present, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. 3 years ago, the Center for Security Policy issued a free online course at MuslimBrotherhoodInAmerica.com. It exposed that Islamic supremacist group's goal of destroying Western civilization from within, and how Brotherhood associates had penetrated our government and were subverting its policies. One of those profiled was Huma Abedin, then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's Deputy Chief of Staff. Five members of Congress, led by Representative Michelle Bachmann, urged the State Department's acting Inspector General to examine Ms. Abedin's ties to the Muslim Brotherhood and role in policymaking. Representative Bachmann was publicly vilified for asking such questions and got no answers to them. Now that a real, independent, and truth-seeking IG is on the job, it's time to investigate Huma's extensive Muslim Brotherhood connection as well as her other problematic and possibly criminal activities. This is Frank Gaffney. Learn more at MuslimBrotherhoodInAmerica.com.
They are fathers and mothers, someone's best friend, and America's true heroes. Whether out on the front lines or here on the home front, our troops are sacrificing every day, making sure that we continue to have the freedoms that make this country great.
Hi, I'm Congressman Chris Stewart. As a former Air Force pilot, I understand that our troops and their families continue to give so much for our country. Let them know you appreciate their service. A simple thank you can go a long way.
Brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign, at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word: answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here.
Do this better than any station in town.
Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Fred Flights with the Center for Security Policy. Now that the June 30th deadline for a nuclear agreement with Iran has passed, Secretary of State John Kerry is in Vienna struggling to finalize an agreement. Listeners to this program know that the nuclear talks are deeply flawed and a bad deal is preordained. We now know one reason for this bad deal is because the Rockefeller Foundation spent millions to back a loose coalition of peace groups, think tanks, and former U.S. officials to push for a nuclear agreement with Iran. This included freelance diplomacy with Iranian officials over the past 10 years. In addition, a core member of this effort is former CIA official Paul Pillar, who wrote a 2012 article titled, "We Can Live with a Nuclear Iran." This explains why a bad deal with Iran will emerge from the nuclear talks. This is another reason why Congress must kill this deal. I'm Fred Flights. Learn more at our new website on the Iran talks, irantruth.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by the 75th governor of the state of New Hampshire, man who also served as the chief of staff of the White House under President George Herbert Walker Bush. He is, of course, John H. Sununu, who has distinguished himself both in public life as well as in the private sector, notably as the president of an engineering company for a number of years and the co-host of Crossfire for a period of time on CNN. He is the author of a new book that is quite important, I think, as a reflection on a history of our country, a period of particular transition, which has some interesting similarities in a way to the ones afoot at the moment. It is entitled The Quiet Man, The Indispensable Presidency of George Herbert Walker Bush. Governor, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Well, thank you for having me on to talk to you.
The pleasure is mine. You, of course, served with President George H.W. Bush and had an opportunity to witness the quiet man, as you call him, close at hand, and a presidency that was in office during an epical moment, specifically the end of the Cold War and the emergence of a new world order. I'd ask you to sort of reflect on that time a little bit from your unique vantage perspective.
Well, as your listeners will remember, Ronald Reagan had really rebuilt America's national security structure, which had withered over a decade or so, a couple of decades. And so by the time the Reagan administration wound down, the Soviet Union was recognizing it really could not compete. And there was a huge opportunity there for the two superpowers to come to an understanding that would reduce the tensions in the world. And George Bush was exactly the right man in the right place at the right time with his diplomatic experience and, frankly, his personal touch, because in an odd way he may have made it look too easy, because it really was not an easy process of getting our allies together to settle on a strategy, a bold strategy, for dealing with that opportunity. But he got Thatcher, he got Mitterrand, he got Kohl, finally all on the same page, and made a couple of really bold proposals, which Gorbachev responded to, and the relaxing of the Soviet grip on Eastern Europe, which had been there since the Second World War ended, began to wither away. Free elections and all that led to the dissolution of the Soviet Union. So it happened quickly. It happened effectively. It happened, as I said earlier, almost too easily. People think, well, it would have happened anyway, but it didn't. It wouldn't have. It needed a master diplomat who understood the geopolitics of not only the day but of history, and had a sense of what had to be done to make it a better future.
Yeah, as you say, he did make it look easy. Could have gone very badly, needless to say. The question that I guess I have for you, Governor, is whether once the evil empire had really unraveled, and there were those, to be sure, among our allies, and I think quite a number in Washington, if my memory serves, who really weren't all that keen on having it go away. I mean, they were comfortable with the old order of things. But once it did, do you think, in hindsight, that we may have missed an opportunity to effect a, well, purging, I guess, for want of a better term, of the old Soviet communist apparatchiks that, it turned out, kind of reorganized and are doing business under Vladimir Putin, sort of under new management, but might not have been had they been really eliminated from the scene? Does that thought occur?
Well, but Frank, the problem in the old Soviet Union, the new Russia, so to speak, is not the specific characters, it's the culture. And if individuals had been removed, equivalents would have risen up to do the same. This is a culture. They are still genetically Bolsheviks, you know, and the oligarchs are just in the DNA. And so you might have flushed the top layer out, and the bottom, the next layer would have risen up, and the same thing would have happened. The problem in the Soviet Union is they have a culture that only respects power. And the biggest mistake we have made today is we have failed to project a sense of power. One of the things George Bush really did was sort of recognized for a microsecond at the time and then forgotten, is he got rid of America's post-Vietnam syndrome, where the U.S. had gone almost a decade and a half, two decades, without projecting power. And part of the reason some of the tensions built up around the world is that people forgot that the U.S. was willing to maintain peace. Until Reagan came back in and rebuilt it with his peace through strength philosophy, and George Bush demonstrated America's willingness to do that by kicking Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait, the world had forgotten that the U.S. was willing to do what had to be done to produce freedom around the world. George Bush changed that. And unfortunately, it has been changed back into the wrong direction by the current administration.
Yeah, I want to visit with you a little bit about that. And again, our guest is Governor John H. Sununu, former governor of New Hampshire, former White House chief of staff under George H.W. Bush, and the author of The Quiet Man, The Indispensable Presidency of George H.W. Bush. Governor, you have sort of touched on this several times. Let me just drill down on it for a moment. There is, to coin a phrase from the Bush administration, which you served, a new world order afoot at the moment. And it does seem to be very much a product of the United States projecting weakness, well, feckless leadership as well, I guess. Give us, in the shortest of short forms, if you would, what the stakes are as you see it.
Well, most bad people in the world, most bad nations, are bullies. And one trademark of a bully is they're smart enough never to pick on somebody stronger than they are. And this administration has projected a weakness of will that has emboldened mischief around the world, and I use that word only politely. There's lots of bad people in this world, and they have been given almost free rein by an administration that has some kind of a philosophy that I never am able to really describe. They may have done the best description themselves when they used the phrase "lead from behind." Lead from behind means cowering behind everyone else, and that seems to be their philosophy. They've created a vacuum that has allowed ISIS to do all that horrible stuff they are doing, and expanding like crazy in Iraq and into Syria, etc. Putin has been. The Iran deal, Putin has been emboldened to try, and he's going to try, if we don't clean this crowd out, to use a phrase that you used earlier, if we don't clean this crowd out in Washington, Putin will continue to try and reconstruct the old Soviet Union.
Yeah, I fear you're right. Let me just ask very quickly, Governor Sununu, you, of course, are from New Hampshire. You have been involved in its politics for a long time. You've written that Hillary Clinton may be in trouble in your state. I think she's in trouble in a lot of places. And I guess I'd ask you to speak not just to the politics of this, but also, if you could quickly, about her well conduct as an official of the United States government as well.
Well, I've been saying for about 3 months that her problems are much more serious than people realize, not just because of the facts of her problems, but because of their mishandling of the issues that have arisen from her problems. We had a former head of the CIA convicted for having classified material on his computer. We actually had a couple of heads of the CIA given trouble, Petraeus and Deutsch. And so Mrs. Clinton has at least matched them in terms of the egregiousness of what she has done. So she has a real problem. The Democratic Party is in a slow panic mode right now. They will have to select if she goes down, and she may fight all the way and be able to sustain herself to get the nomination. And one of the reasons I think she might be tempted to do that is that her best protection against a criminal investigation is to be the Democratic nominee. And so she may fight hard to stay there. A few months ago, I was worried she was going to get the Democratic nomination. Now I'm worried she may not.
Governor Sununu, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but I do hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Your insights are deeply appreciated, as is your service to our country. Come back to us, and we'll talk next with Congressman Randy Weber. We'll get his take on, among other things, this Iran deal and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement, and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. The Obama administration's efforts to defend the controversial nuclear deal with Iran has become ugly, very ugly. Last week, during a speech at American University, the president portrayed opponents of the deal as partisan Republicans in common cause with Death to America chanting Iranian hardliners. The Tablet, a daily online Jewish magazine, ran an editorial on August 7th claiming that the president is using code anti-Semitic language to criticize Jewish Americans for opposing the Iran deal and to blame them if the deal is rejected by Congress. Some liberal pro-Obama groups have gone further and have questioned the loyalty to this country of Jewish members of Congress who oppose the deal, such as New York Senator Chuck Schumer. The president and his supporters are stooping to smearing opponents of the deal because the agreement is so awful and they cannot defend it on its merits. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Congressman Randy Weber. He represents the people of the 14th District of Texas, serving in the United States House of Representatives, among other things, on its Committee on Foreign Affairs, notably the subcommittees on the Middle East and North Africa, and Europe, Eurasia, and emerging threats, very much on our mind at the moment. He is also a member of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. He chairs its Energy Subcommittee. So a man with considerable responsibilities in areas of great interest to our listeners here at Secure Freedom Radio. Congressman, great to have you with us. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Frank. Glad to be here.
You have been a skeptic, I think it's fair to say, and now that it's been produced, rightly so, a critic of the Iran, well, I call it the Obama bomb deal. Talk a little bit about why you believe this deal should be rejected by your colleagues when they come back in September.
Well, it is a bad deal, Frank. There is no question to it. Benjamin Netanyahu, when he came here March the 3rd, did a great speech to the joint session of Congress. Sad to say that the president would not to meet with him. Had time to meet with David Letterman and do YouTube videos, you know, for different groups, but not meet with our greatest ally. So I would have to argue that the president's foreign policy, I've been saying lack thereof, is really putting not just us in harm's way, but Israel as well as much of the world. And you just look around the world to see that. Now, and I've been to the classified facility to read all the backup documents on it. I don't have a lot of confidence that the intelligence community can track everything that needs to be tracked in dealing with Iran. Iran has a history of lying, of cheating, of covert operations. I actually had this conversation with the Secretary of State, John Kerry, you know, during the hearing. The president said he was going to negotiate from a position of strength and power. And I said, well, when did he decide to give that up? Because there was five things I felt like should have been done just in the discussion itself, the negotiation. Number one, they should have made Iran, if they're going to be serious about rejoining the world community as a good neighbor, so to speak, they needed to give up all their hostages, first and foremost. Prove their intent to be a good neighbor. Number two, they needed to stop all their centrifuges and dismantle them. Even the ones they had been hiding, they needed to come clean with anywhere, anytime, investigations or people could thank you, where they could go in and look at them. Not this 24-day period that they wound up negotiating. Number three, they needed to stop the rhetoric, destroy death to America, death to Israel. You do know that the Ayatollah Khamenei has called Israel a one bomb nation. In other words, once they do get the nuclear bomb, they drop Israel. Israel, as we know it, ceases to exist. Number four, they need to prove over a period of time that they can, you know, they took out hostages in 1979 at the Tehran embassy. And so that's been, what, 36 years ago? Let's give them 36 months to prove that they're serious. And number five, they need to recognize Israel's right to exist, because they've made no qualms that they want to destroy Israel. They want to destroy America. Why didn't we require all that? And then once they had proven, say, 36 months or 24 months, that they could be a good actor, then and only then would the sanctions begin to be released. That's the substantive part of the negotiations that I think the United States should have held out for.
Well, and what you've really laid out are the terms that would make it a reasonable deal from our perspective, especially giving $150 billion by some estimates to this regime under any other circumstances is really irresponsible and downright dangerous, as you pointed out in the cross-examination of some of the witnesses in the Foreign Affairs Committee. Congressman Weber, I wanted to turn to you, though, with specificity to something that I think you've been focusing on both in the emerging threats context in the Foreign Affairs Committee and I know in the Science Committee, namely the threats to our electric grid and the possibility that a regime in Iran that means what they say about death to America isn't just sloganeering, hasn't been for decades, but is intent on pursuing that objective, may be able to accomplish were they to take down our grid through electromagnetic pulse or sabotage or cyber or other means.
Well, that's exactly right, Frank. And that's why I said you would find out later that all three of these are subjects are kind of intertwined. If you watched Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey said that we didn't want to do away with the conventional weapons ban. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagelin said the same thing. And so what does Kerry do at the end? They negotiate away the conventional weapons ban. They give that away. Now,
potentially
Iran
quite soon, as a matter of fact, not just 5 years from now.
That's right. And Iran is working on their ICBMs, and I forget who it was that said intercontinental ballistic missiles. There's a reason the first word in that ICBM is intercontinental. electromagnetic pulse, what people don't realize, it's not just nuclear. There's actually a system that they can put on the tip of a rocket. It's a bank of capacitors that releases electric charge. It doesn't have to be nuclear, although it'll be great. We are helping them build up their nuclear facilities. This administration is so smart. But they can actually send an ICBM over here. It doesn't have to have a nuclear warhead on it, per se. They can introduce EMP into our atmosphere with a different, it's actually called hemp. It's a H-E-M-P, which some people would argue proves hemp is dangerous. It's a high altitude electromagnetic pulse, H-E-M-P. So they can deliver a missile over here to destroy our grid, or actually to seriously adversely affect our grid, and don't even have to have a nuclear weapon. Why in the world would we let these people out under these sanctions, release them from conventional weapons ban, and give them their money back? This administration just either doesn't understand the threat or absolutely doesn't care.
Yeah, or is, at the very least, whatever their motives, compounding that threat for sure. And I appreciate so much your understanding, Congressman Randy Weber, of this real danger to America. This isn't just to Israel. This isn't just to other interests of ours or allies elsewhere, but to Americans as well. Congressman, let me ask you one other thing, if I may. You have recently co-sponsored and secured House passage of H.R. 3009, entitled the Enforce the Law for Sanctuary Cities Act. What is the problem here? Isn't it illegal to have sanctuary cities already?
Well, great question, Frank. When I served 2 terms, 4 years in the Texas legislature. My second term, I was the vice chairman of the Borders Committee. I can tell you the Texas DPS, we had briefings with them. There's 30 or 40 different Eastern religious sects, S-E-C-T-S, coming across our southern border. Just for information, of the almost 2,000 miles that Mexico and the United States shares with the border, Texas has 1,179 of those miles, almost two-thirds of that border. Texas is a big state. We understand the threat. DPS said that we've got people coming over.
Public safety, of course. Yep.
Oh, absolutely. Texas Department of Public Safety, thank you. We had briefings. We understand the threat. When you talk about sanctuary cities, people who say, we won't prosecute you if you just come into our area. And, of course, Kate's law that's now up, Kate Steinle's death could have been prevented by, what was it, 7-time convicted felon? I think two things we're doing that are good, Salmon's bill and, of course, Duncan Hunter's bill, Matt Salmon, Duncan Hunter, increasing the penalties to 5-year minimum jail facility, illegal. A felon in the United States, they've got to go into the federal pen 5 years minimum, period. And then, of course, if we stop the funding to sanctuary cities, when it's determined that it could be a city, a county, or whatever, when there's policies in place that don't enforce federal immigration law, and in fact look the other way and encourage people to come, as it were, take sanctuary in their city, then we ought to shut off federal funding to that city.
Amen.
Until they start helping us.
We are hard out of time. I thank you so much for your leadership on all of these fronts. We look forward to seeing you play that role when you come back in September, and wish you the best in the meantime in that glorious state of Texas of yours. Keep it up and come back to us again if you would soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.